Kirsten Appelt. I'm the Research Director for UBC Decision Insights for Business and Society, or DIBS for short, and I'm here to kick us off. So I'd like to ask everyone to stay on mute unless you're asking a question so we don't get too much background noise. But you can either raise your hand to ask a question or use the chat. Eric will probably speak more up front and then take questions at the end, but if there's the occasional question during, that's also fine. And as well, if you'd like to have your video on, it always makes it a little more engaging for the speaker than seeing a sea of black boxes, but also understand if you're doing the Peloton or something else at the same time and prefer to stay off screen. I'd also like to take a moment to recognize that many of us are joining from the traditional and ancestral lands of Indigenous peoples. For myself and many of the folks at UBC, we're joining from the lands of the Coast Salish peoples, the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, and we'd like to express our gratitude to them. We invite you to recognize your own hosts, whether that's mentally or in the chat. And if you're not familiar with the Indigenous caretakers of your land, there's a really nice Canadian resource, Indigenous-led, called native-land.ca. And in that spirit of welcome and gratitude, I'd like to mention and honor and introduce our speaker today. We're thrilled to have Dr. Eric Johnson with us. Eric is the inaugural holder of the Norman Ike Chair of Business at Columbia University. He's the director of the Center for Decision Sciences at Columbia's Business School. He's the author of the indispensable new book, The Elements of Choice, and that adjective is not only mine, but also Danny Kahneman's. And on a personal note, we're really happy to welcome Eric because he's a very good friend of UBC DIBS. I was very fortunate to work with Eric. He was my postdoc advisor at Columbia University, and he was also one of Dave's PhD advisors at Columbia. So you could say that when it comes to DIBS, Eric gets the credit or blame for about 40% of the core team. We'll let you all decide if that's credit or blame. And on a less personal note, whether you realize it or not, you're already very familiar with some of Eric's work. And I'm not going to reel off his impressive stats today because that would take quite a while, but I just want to give you an example, and I'm going to pull something that doesn't have a standard metric. And that's, I think that Eric probably holds the title for one of the top most viewed graphs in the world. Every BI student or enthusiast has seen Eric's figure comparing organ donation rates across opt-in and opt-out countries. And that's just one example of the amazing work that Eric has done in the realm of choice architecture. And that's work we're all thrilled and excited to hear about today. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to you, Eric, and I'll stop my screen share so that you can start yours.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for that incredibly warm and generous welcome. And let me do the important thing of getting the screen share going, which I think we have hopefully succeeded in doing. And so I'm thrilled to be here, not as thrilled as if I was going to be there in person, which would have been even more fun. But it's great to be with you, and it's great to see how much development has gone on with DIBS since it started about 2016, so it's fantastic, and it's fantastic to see everyone there today, including old and hopefully new friends. Here's what I want to talk about. Okay, we're on the right page now. I'm going to talk based on a book, but also based with two major goals. One is, I want to convince you that choice architecture is important. In fact, no matter how important you think it is, it's probably more important than you know. The second thing I want to tell you about how it works, because as we think about nudges and we think about choice architecture, one thing that's quite clear is that it's a powerful phenomena without a powerful set of explanatory principles about how it works. Let me start by convincing the first part, which is that choice architecture makes a big difference. In fact, I'm working hard to come up with a new example. Many of you saw the stock market in the US tank yesterday because Meta, AKA Facebook, dived in terms of the number of visitors. And one of the reasons, it turns out, is Apple changed the default. To be tracked across websites, you had to opt in. And in fact, the reality is that before that, you were tracked and you had to opt out through a rather arduous process to do that. And you know, I'll take an effect that's $10 billion a year to Facebook as being big. I don't know what the Cohen's D for that would be, but that's certainly significant. So the other example I talk about in the book is that Google and Apple signed a deal for Google to be the default search engine in iOS. Originally it was worth $1 billion. It's now worth $12 to $15 billion. There's an analyst now who's saying $15 billion simply to have a pre-check box. That's pretty impressive. And Google's a great product as a search engine, and it has a 90% share. Part of that is because it's good, but the other part of it is because it's the default. I'll just ask you to think about what you think would happen if Bing, Microsoft search engine, was the default. I think the number would be very different. This has been actually a big part of a litigation between the FTC, who sees this as this one little dot being pre-checked as being anti-competitive. So it raises an important question, which is how do defaults like this work? Why are they so sticky? So that's one question that goes to the point of theory. The other is, what other choice architectures are there? I mean, it's one tool, maybe the poster child for what's going for choice architecture, but it's not the only thing that goes on. So let me start with a kind of controversial statement. It's an illusion that we alone are responsible for our choices. Mm-hmm. Okay? We do have agency. We do make choices. But the person who got there before us makes decisions that influence us. I'm going to share a couple examples. One is one that was done by someone who was a PhD student here at Columbia in medical informatics. And she works on electronic health records. These are the systems that doctors sit in, and they are typing continually. When you go to a doctor these days, the first most important thing they look at is you. But the second most important, about 30% of the time they're in the visit with you, is this screen. And here's the problem. When you prescribe drugs, generics are often much cheaper. In fact, they're about a fifth the cost of the brand name drug. So one drug, Allegra, which is antihistamine, costs about five times the generic. Now, I had to work on this hard. The generic's name is fexofenadine hydrochloride. You can all repeat with me, but it's not the most mellifluous title. But even though they get many alerts, they're educated. Doctors prescribe generics only 46% of the time in this particular hospital, which is Mount Sinai on the east side of New York. But researchers, Jessica Anker and her team, found a way to boost it to over 96%. Now, I think this is a cute story because it tells you why you need a theory of how choice architecture works. So how would you do it? They basically realized two very important facts. When I said Allegra, that was easy to remember. Fexofenadine hydrochloride, not so easy. Okay. The other thing is doctors are very busy, and even if you remember the name fexofenadine hydrochloride, you'd have to remember to type it out, etc. So they did something very simple. They basically pre-populated the fields, but if you type the name of the brand name drug, say you typed Allegra, A-L-L, it would pre-populate with fexofenadine hydrochloride. And what did that do? Well, that increased the share of generic drugs by a factor of two. And doctors could easily undo that. There was a little bit, say, prescribed the non-generic, but over 90% of doctors kept the generic drug. So what it is this very small amount of effort seemed to be able to change their behavior. It's kind of remarkable, actually. And it really illustrates the two key principles that I think drive choice architecture. The first is the idea that small amounts of effort really change the information we consider. So in this case, having to type fexofenadine made its market share next to zero. The second thing is that the role of memory is very important. The fact that you could retrieve the brand name. And in this case, doctors particularly know the brand name because they were detailed. That is, people came to sell them the drug. Salespeople gave them pens with the name Allegra, and not a pen with fexofenadine hydrochloride. So it was very accessible to them. And that combination was a huge advantage for the non-generic drug. This isn't just about, by the way, savings for hospitals. Something I should say is that generics actually make a difference in people's lives. If your income is limited, a common thing that happens is people either don't refill or take space out medications, and that has real implications for their health. And so by using generics, you not only save money for the healthcare system, but also increase compliance for the doctors. So that's really a nice example. The other thing I'll note is Everything I'm talking about here is not a standard piece of choice architecture. It's not a default. It's something that it feels like choice architecture. It is choice architecture, but it doesn't quite fit in the standard set of tools that you would think about. It's not a norm, it's not something else. So there's a lot of choice architecture to be developed yet and for a theory. Let me give you a couple little vocabulary. First piece is I want to say you guys all have a job you don't know you have, and you're designers. That is, every time you pose a choice to somebody else, you are in fact a choice architect, or because it's easier, I'm going to say designer. And you're making decisions about how to present information to people that is actually going to influence their choices. When Dave and Kristen talk about which restaurant to go to dinner, someone is actually selecting a order to present the options. Should we go to Thai, Chinese, Italian? That's going to have an influence on the choice. And yet I suspect whoever is making that choice, and we'll pick between Dave and Kirsten, but someone is actually unaware of what they're doing. Maybe you guys are thinking ahead of the game, but most of us are making these choices without really knowing about it. So we are choice architects all the time. And of course, we're also people who make choices, people I'll call choosers. And so the book is about designers becoming more aware of the power they have. I'm just going to stop, have a sip of tea, and see if there are any questions, because I like interaction between
Dave, go for it.
Sure. So, first of all, you're
going to ask me which way to make the list.
I was actually curious about an idea you have on the last slide, and if you could talk a little more about constructing preferences versus assembling preferences versus accessing, you know, preferences. And so,
right.
There we go. Yeah, I see. Yeah. I'm just queuing you up here.
Yeah. So that's great. So for the cognoscenti, the people who study decision-making for a while, there's a phrase called constructive preferences. And that means basically we're making up our preferences on the spot. And I've renamed that assembled preferences. So it's the same concept, but one important distinction. When you say constructive preferences, people often think I'm making things up out of whole cloth. There's nothing there. I think the real battle is we have too many preferences. And it's what subset of those get pulled out at the time that matters. So if I'm trying to choose a meal, I know a lot of things I want. I want to be spelt, I want to eat healthy, I want something rich, I want something tasty. And which of that, I have too many preferences, only a small subset of those. So the reason I use assembling is because I'm picking some subset. I'm not making things up. So that's the phrase. But it's essentially, in fact, and plausible paths is such a strategy selection. But I think these capture in some sense something most walking around people, you know, can understand. And particularly with constructing preferences, it's something that prevents a misunderstanding. Does that help? Any other questions?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I like it. Interesting, subtle, but an important terminology change.
Here. So let me give you one other example, which is one that is New York-based. And it turns out in about 2009, New York cabs adopted this great display. Essentially, when you got out of the cab, you got to choose how much to tip the cabbie. And on the left-hand side, you'll see it says 15, 20, and 25%. On the right-hand side, it says 20, 25, and 30%. And what's interesting about this is I can just type in any tip number and hit and say, okay. So they're just suggestions. I actually have to make an active choice. These are not the points. Okay. Yet research shows that cabbies get 27% higher tips if they see the 20, 25, 30% menu. In fact, on average, cabbies make 5 to 10% more a day when they happen to get a cab that has the right-hand display as opposed to the left-hand display. And this is actually interesting because obviously it costs the rider money. It has an influence, both on the rider and also on the cabbie. So it's interesting. And yet you can't make an argument that there's anything particularly strong about this manipulation. It's not like it's really hard to type in $12. It's not, you could do any tip you can. The other thing that's interesting is people worry when they see the 20, 25, 30 tip, then maybe people will stop tipping entirely. And it turns out there's a very small, like from 2% of people who start stiffing cabbies, not giving them any money. But that's way overwhelmed by the people who give more tips. Just to give you a sense of how big of an effect this is, if you look at just the number of people who leave 15% tips, it's 6%, six times more on the left-hand side, where you can actually press the 15% button, than the right-hand side. So this is very powerful, and you've seen this probably now in almost any delivery app, where you basically get to choose a tip, and they actually give you a range. It's interesting because we've all tipped. This is not something that's new. It's not a surprise you have to give a tip. But deciding what the appropriate tip is an assembled preference. Okay. So let me sort of walk through the two key concepts here. The first one is that, look, people look at a small part of the information that's available for most decisions. You walk down a supermarket aisle, you're surfing Amazon. There are many options, many attributes. You're going to look at a small part. And if you can change what information is looked at, you can change choices. And a lot of what choice architecture is doing is changing information that's looked at. And what determines that is pretty simple. You do it by looking at what's easy to look at, particularly at the beginning of a decision. So that's a really important driver. Small changes in effort will make a big difference in outcome because it changes what you consider. I had said that memory was important. And often, to the point of assembled preferences that Dave asked about, people often don't know what they want. They decide when they're choosing. And so what comes to mind at that point is important. And if you think about the example of eating food, if I think about delicious food, I think about fatty food, I think about all sorts of things, I'm going to choose differently. So if the choice architecture can change what I consider, it's going to change what I choose. I think these two drivers, these two forces, explain a lot of what happens with choice architecture. And so a goal of the book is to actually understand how choice architecture works, in part so we know when it's going to be powerful and when it's not. I'll stop there again for questions. Please, Liana.
Hi. So I was just curious. I was really fascinated when you said that you can change what information people look at by making it easier to look at. What does that mean exactly?
Let me give you an example. But a simple thing is, if you can imagine lots of things you can do, like what is the order of options? Okay, if you're going to be sensitive to ease, you may start looking from left to right. Or from top to bottom. That would be an example of ease driving choices if there's an influence. And I'll hopefully convince you that there are. So it's a great question. And examples to follow.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Teresa or Teresa?
Hi. Yes, something that you just said, or the last thing that you said about knowing when choice architecture would make a big, like a greater impact, I think is what you said.
Yes.
What sorts of factors would you consider when considering like if it would be or make a bigger impact?
It's going to depend a bit on the intervention, but I think basically the way to think about this is it going to change the information that people look at, the plausible path, and will it change what comes to mind? And let me hold that off a little bit till we get to defaults, because I think that's a place where it would be very,
okay,
a little bit clearer. But because that's the poster child, as I keep saying, in many ways, of choice architecture. Any other questions? Those are good ones. Okay, so let me describe a little bit more what I mean by plausible paths. Plausible path essentially is the idea that people look at a subset of everything they could look at, and that's usually what's very easy. And I tell the story, I actually ended up doing a lot of reading on the famous landing of U.S. Air Flight 1549 on the Hudson River. If I had been home that day, I would have seen the flight literally land, or at least glide by my window. You might remember this is Sully, the famous movie. And there were 288 seconds from the time the plane's engines hit geese and he landed in the Hudson. And let me set up one other thing about that. That day, the air temperature was, I think, 19 degrees, and water temperature was 34 degrees. And he had a really important decision to make, which was, does he try to go back to LaGuardia? Does he try and go to the general aviation airport of Teterboro? Or does he try what pilots would call ditch the plane in the river? Now, you know, clearly a lot of things went on, and Sully had literally tens of thousands of hours of experience flying that particular plane. But what's interesting is this is the cockpit, and it turns out one element here called the green dot indicator, I think, gets a lot of credit, should have gotten the key to the city. Here's the story. This little gauge combines four different things you should look at, four different attributes. You need to fly the plane as far as possible, be at the right angle, and be at the right speed. And you're actually observing what the actual speed is, what the actual angle is. What this gauge does is basically say, here is the green dot, you should try and get this yellow bar to the green dot. Now, what's fascinating about that is that's pretty easy. That might seem easy to do, and might be, but it's not. And what you have, and what this does is tell you not only where you are, but also what direction you're going in. So in this case, the pilot is slowing down, and that's bad. If you want to fly further, you would have to pull back on the stick and get this to match this. Sully reports that this was very important to him, and in fact, there's a checklist he used that they should use to go this, and this is the bottom of the second page of the checklist. They would have crashed long before they got to this. And to save this function, it's what's called, I'll just go back quickly, a glass cockpit. These are all electronic gauges. He had to turn on an auxiliary generator to get this to work. And he did that as soon as he hit the keys. He somehow knew that this was a really important aid. And he ends up saying something which I think is really important. By the way, this is what how you could have designed it. This is what I call bad choice architecture. You could have asked him to try and do all the things the gauge is doing instead by looking at these. Of course, he's an expert. He should be able to do it. He said, so I quickly set priorities. I load shed, pared down this problem to its essential elements, did the few things that had to be done, and did them very well. I was willing to goal sacrifice. I knew the highest priority was to save lives. I was more than willing to give up and trying to save the plane early on to save that. By load shed, he's borrowing a phrase from electric power generation. If you're having a shortage of electric power, I hope no one from Texas is in trouble right now, but if you're having that kind of situation, you actually have a very serious problem. Who do you give the resources to? So you would typically give it to the hospital and turn down the manufacturing plants because it's a matter of life and death. What Sully says is he has to direct his attention to the important parts of the decision and not worry about others. And he reports that gauge was very, very important. In fact, the gauge enabled him to decide to actually land. He had been to, it turns out, that area and knew that that area of the Hudson River was full of ferry boats, police boats. And so even though the weather was very cold, there could be an immediate rescue. Otherwise, people would have been in big trouble if they had to get in the water. As I read this more and more, I realized that cockpit displays are a very elaborately designed form of choice architecture. They help pilots make decisions. In fact, one of my favorite examples is a very nice description from a guide to cockpit displays. It says, does it give the pilot the information he needs, or she, only what he or she needs? And only when he or she needs it? And does it give them the information in ways that are intuitive, ambiguous, and easy to understand? If not, it's clutter. So I'm going to just skip ahead a couple slides and try and share with you a display which helps people make credit card choices. And I'll show you a movie of someone using it. Now, there are about 108 different credit cards here. Lots of attributes, and I'd argue that if you gave people the chance to find the right credit card for them, there's a lot of what you would call clutter. People are going to make mistakes, and to be honest, question, being first in this list is going to actually influence your search enormously. So that's what I mean by clutter. Let me give you one other example you might not normally think of as choice architecture, but it's one that I found really interesting, and that's dating sites. About half of all Americans meet their spouse on one of these sites these days, which I find incredible. And I want to talk about two sites. The one on the left is Tinder. And infinitely, Tinder presents you with almost an infinite number of options. The one on the right is called Coffee Meets Bagel. It was designed actually by three women for women. And it early on made a very important decision. They relaxed us a little bit, but still, and that they were going to show you one potential match a day. Well, let me ask you, do you think the information people look at on those two sites are different? On Tinder, I basically probably look at one attribute. My guess is it's the picture, and then move on. In fact, there's even a cute phrase from the Urban Dictionary about a condition called Tinder thumb, which is the feeling of ennui you feel when you realize the universe is infinite and not very good. It's a little bit more descriptive than that, but you get the general idea. However, on Coffee Meets Bagel, people report they look at more than just the picture. They say, I have a lot of time. This is the person I see today. Let me read their biography. Let me read what they're into. Let me look at more data. And at least I suspect, and it's actually quite clear, that people eliminate options very quickly on Tinder-like sites with lots of options. They look more carefully at other attributes on Coffee Meets Bagel types options. So that's another case where the choice architecture changes the plausible path, the information that people look at. Any questions about that? Great. So plausible paths are one of the big drivers. There's another big driver, and that's assembled preferences. Dave asked a little bit about this, but we know that if we're gonna use memory, memory can be triggered by many different things. I don't know if anyone has seen the British mentalist Darren Brown, but he can read people's minds. And when you dig deeply into what he does, it turns out he's not a mind reader. He basically makes certain memories very accessible. And when you do that, you actually just report what you've made more accessible. I have hidden a slide that I want to unhide, so give me 1 second. I may have to get out of this mode. But it's a very important slide because it's about research that Kirsten did. Everyone can see the slides now? They're back, I hope.
Still seeing your background.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Now you're seeing my presentation view.
Yeah.
Now we're back.
Now we're seeing. Oh, Max.
Yes.
We'll vamp for you while you find
okay.
Them.
Sorry about that.
No worries. One might say that the Max could have better choice architecture for finding your dominant screen.
Yes, exactly. That's absolutely true. Let's try one more time. I'm going to quickly screen share the other screen. I think that would be easier. Sorry about that, folks. Now, hopefully you're seeing a slide.
It's slow to load. Yep, there we go. Perfect.
Okay, good. So there we go. So one example of making information more accessible is a nice study done by Irwin Levin and colleagues, where they actually would label ground beef either 20% fat or 80% lean. And they showed that people actually were thought of very different things in those conditions. When it was 80% lean, they said people thought it was protein, it was helping build muscle. 20% fat, they started thinking about clogging arteries. Now notice 80% lean and 20% fat are exactly the same. In fact, they actually asked people how much you would pay for both, and they found differences in how they tasted and what people were willing to pay. So that's actually quite a good example. But an example I want to share with you, which is why I screwed up the slides, was work that I had done with Kirsten many years ago with others. And that is, often in economics, we should be thinking about our longevity. Many of us never think about this, or at least don't think about it until our demise is more imminent. But you could ask the question two different ways. You could ask, how long will you live to? Or when will you die by? Now, we're obviously talking about the same year. But when we ask people if their probability that they will live to 50 or live to 80 or die by 50 or die by 80, they think very different things. They're the same question, but we think very different things about when we answer them. So when you die by, you probably think about your Aunt Edna who had a heart attack at 74. You think about the pains you've had that day. You think about the fact that you don't eat well and you don't exercise. And when we ask people die by questions, the median is 75.1 years. Yet if I ask the live to question, what happens? Well, then we tend to think about healthy people, the fact we're going to start working out next week, that our Uncle Sam lived to 96. And in fact, those people say they'll live to 84.9 years. In fact, asking the question differently produces almost a 10-year difference in how long you think you will live, because it just makes some information in memory more accessible than another. And thanks to Kirsten, we could actually estimate that there are a couple years of longevity added, expected longevity, unfortunately, by simply thinking of another reason you will live longer. So there's a really strong connection. So let me quickly give you an example. Many people, I think, know what happens when a box is pre-checked on the web. Kirsten was kind of talking about the work we had done with organ donation, where defaults makes a big difference in people's agreement to do that. Now, I could argue that basic defaults, we have done analyses, work hugely sometimes and not so hugely other times. And I'll give you one very quick reason why. Different default situations to the question about what I meant by factors tap three different processes. One thing is defaults make decisions easy. They change the plausible paths. They say, I'll just take the default. I won't look at any information. A second thing is they change the way we assemble our preferences. If I'm defaulted to a condition, I will think mostly about the things that I'm defaulted to. So if I am being defaulted to being an organ donor, I might think more about the reasons a good thing to be a donor and less about the reasons I wouldn't want to be a donor. Finally, there's a third E. So there's endowment and endorsement. And ease is endorsement. And that essentially is saying, look, whoever's imposing the choice architect, the designer, is actually encouraging me to do that. And we've done analyses where we basically try and predict the size of the default effect by the presence or absence of those three factors. And there's definitely evidence that ease, endorsement, and endowment all contribute to the size of the default effect. It's marginal, of course, in the case of endorsement, but I think that's because it's a meta-analysis and there's not that much variation. But notice, by understanding if it's working through plausible paths or assembled preferences, we're actually able to understand when defaults will be big, like 80%, or small, like 2%. And so I think that's one of the advantages of thinking about these factors and actually having a theory of choice architecture. The last sort of major theme I want to talk about are the different tools. But before I get there, I'm going to have a sip of tea and see if anyone has questions. Please, I think Dave was first, then Liana.
Sure, just a quick comment about the, by the way, I love the three E's way of remembering the different factors of defaults. And maybe one example.
I teach marketing after all. I think I'm yeah. Handy.
And so maybe one example where defaults don't work well, although I haven't seen data on it, but just intuitively, is when you're signing up for something online and there's the, like, would you like to receive our, you know, marketing right. emails, right? I mean, I would guess the default's a lot weaker there due to that endorsement right. factor and the fact that maybe you don't, if you don't trust the person's endorsement, it could even be the opposite, where you do the right. opposite of the default. So I would guess you get a big effect there. I'm surprised it doesn't come out that strongly in meta-analysis, but maybe, like you're saying, it just hasn't been studied.
I think that's the problem with meta-analysis. You only can see what has been varied in prior studies. Leanna.
It's funny because I'm also a marketer, so I'm always about show me the evidence, right? Show me the case studies. So I'm curious, what are some examples of where you saw like the defaults being used effectively, the proper endow, endorse, ease? Has someone really nailed that from your experience?
Well, I can tell you a couple stories of what I will call world's record default effects. And probably one of the better ones, which is very relevant to anyone who's interested in sustainability, is defaulting people into green energy suppliers. There have now been a lot of studies now, and that's actually kind of interesting because obviously in these studies, often it's the state utility. So many of them have been done in Europe, Switzerland, and Germany, and they typically have retention rates about 90%. You default someone into the green energy policy, and they stick with it. 90% of the people stay with that policy, which is actually pretty remarkable. And I think it's because that decision is done once. It's confusing to most people, so it's easy. And they think there's endorsement. And they think, and I don't have any evidence, frankly, of this, is they're thinking about the advantages of green energy when they make the decision, as opposed to thinking about the added cost. So it gets more complicated than that, but that would be one candidate. Maybe someone else has other favorite examples of big and small default effects. I think Dave has one that, you know, it's there, it's positive. People don't have reactors yet, but that's it. But I mean, those tend to be on the smaller end of the scale.
That's great, thank you. I'm actually in that business, but for Canada. So I would be very fascinated to pick your brain a bit more about what Switzerland and Germany are doing.
I'd be glad to. I mean, I suspect Dave and Kirsten know a lot about this, but I'd be happy to talk about this. Sasha, I think you're next.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. And my question is about the number of choices that are made available. I always say the optimum number of choices made available, just because from the examples we've seen, like for example, the credit card, too many choices overwhelm consumers. But having too little is not good either. So what's the happy medium in terms of the number, for example, of choices that should be made available to consumers from a consumer standpoint? And how do you find that happy medium?
I will get to that in a second. I think given our timing, and we've had a great discussion, I'm probably going to pick a couple of these tools to talk about. I'll definitely talk about the number of options because I think that's a fun and interesting and really important one. One quick point I'll make is all these things are actually important and often have effects that at the extreme can be as important as defaults, yet defaults get all the credit. And so there, you have lots more tools than just defaults. Teresa, or Teresa, I apologize.
Yeah, it's okay, it's Teresa, thank you. It would be helpful for me if you could speak to the differences between ease, endowment, and endorsement, like what the differences between those three defaults?
Sure. So ease is basically, you see a default and you say, good enough, making a decision is too hard, I'm gonna accept the default. That's, I think, many people's intuitive theory about how the defaults work. And if that were true, they'd have no effect on important decisions like retirement savings. Okay. Endowment is essentially when you're deciding the person who's posing the question, the designer, thinks it's the best thing for you, and you trust them, as Dave pointed out. Now, endowment's a little bit more complicated. This is where you stretch to get the three E's, but it's as if you already own the defaulted option. And we know that one of the things that happens with endowment is you think more about the option you currently own or you possess. There's a whole theory of value construction that Elke Weber and I have developed along with some of the people on this call, actually, called query theory. And query theory says you focus on the first option or the default option, and that causes you not to think about the other option. So to go to the electricity example, I might be thinking a lot about the advantages of having green energy and not as much about the disadvantages, which are usually expense. Does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thanks. I am going to try and keep us closer to time. I think... go ahead and talk about number options because that was a good question. One of the things about choosing is changing the number of options can change people's plausible path. we've already talked about this. When I talked about Tinder versus Coffee Meets Bagel, I essentially went from a strategy where I screen. I look at who has managed to get a good, cute shot of themselves, even if they're not very cute, to something where I look at the other attributes, like what they do for a living, where they live, other attributes. That's an example of how more options lead you to screen. A good example of how people don't agree on how many options there is the AHA, the Obamacare exchanges. Last I looked, Alaska, Mississippi had 5 options. Only could choose from 5 policies. New York State had 8 options. Utah, when the policies were originally introduced, had 124 options. Okay. Now, I would argue those are going to produce different kind of strategies. And to answer your question about what's the right number of options, I think you need to think about what is the right strategy. I would argue in dating sites, perhaps you want to look at more than the picture, particularly if the picture is not terribly accurate. And I think in healthcare, you want to look at more than one attribute. There's some evidence that people overweighted the effect of premium when you give them more options. They basically look and say, what's the cheapest policy? Where really they need to be making trade-offs between the premium, what's covered, and other costs like what the deductible is. And in work that we have done, we've shown that actually more options lead to worse choices in that case. At the same time, when you add each option, you're adding another alternative. And if those options are different, that can be useful to the decision maker. So there's a trade-off here between trying to minimize screening and also give people good options. If you give people only 3 health insurance plans, you may not be giving one that's closest to what they need. So there's a trade-off between additional quality in the choice set and additional burden to the decision maker. And so I go on in the book about this and try, but to get you the intuition, basically, if all the options are alike, a small set will do. If the options differ a lot, you have to think about a trade-off between the options being different and that. Let me give you an example I love from the book, which is New York City kids who are finished 8th grade have to pick a high school. I think New York City actually probably did this with great sincerity. A Nobel Prize winner, Al Roth, designed the system for them along with colleagues. And essentially you got to pick from a list of 769 different schools. The choice architecture they used was a paper book that looked like an old school telephone directory. And it had about 16 attributes for each of the options. Now, a lot of that information is not useful for somebody. In fact, what you could have done and what was done is redesign that. Let's only look at schools that are within 30 minutes of my house, eliminating a bunch of them. Because those options don't add any value to the consumer. Let's maybe look at only good schools, and they operationalize good school by saying it has to graduate at least, I think it was 70% of the students. Sadly, there are lots of high schools in New York City that don't graduate 70% of the students. Those are probably not good schools. You probably don't need to spend your time looking at them. So this balance between getting the right number of options, making it smaller, making sure you have the right options in there is, I think, the kind of complicated answer to the question. Did that help you, though? I think that was good. Let's see, how are we on time? We're doing fine, I think. Good. I'm going to throw things open to wider questions for just 5 minutes at the end. But let me talk about one other, I think, really relevant concept for people for designers. And most of this I'm talking about are things that could have been done on paper. But the reality is we are actually using something that I call choice engines, borrowing the phrase from some colleagues. Choice engines are interactive environments. You're not showing everybody the same options. You're not showing everybody the same defaults. That actually a choice engine can be customized given what you know about the decision maker. I argue that there are 3 C's here. First thing is that you can customize the design for each person. So if I know you are somebody who's looking for a college prep school, to use the New York example, I can decide not only to choose that I show you only college prep schools. Or even better, I can pre-select one of the options. That default can be customized to you, as opposed to what's normally done, which is one default fits all. I can actually make what we call, and this is due to Dan Goldstein and myself, among others, a smart default. The default that reflects the best guess we know for you. Choice engines also give customers control. That is, I can actually decide to eliminate options or to sort. I can be my own choice architect. I can be my own designer. So if I'm a particularly cheap person, I can decide to sort by price. That may or may not be good, but I can do that. And finally, something that we don't typically think about as being part of choice architecture, but it really is increasing comprehension. A good choice engine can teach you about the options. So for example, with healthcare, it turns out lots of people think a deductible is a good thing. Having a balloon help tell you what a deductible is can improve decision making. So these are all three things. So let me tell you two quick examples and then I'll close. I suspect some of you have used one or the other, or maybe even both. It turns out that a wonderfully complicated choice engine is Netflix. Now, Netflix essentially has to make a ton of designs, decisions. They essentially produce a landing page, a program page, that's customized for each person. This is why when you go to Netflix, it says, who's watching? Kirsten or Dave. Because it's actually customizing the page for that person. And it's deciding things like what order to put each of these rows in, which options to put in each of these rows. They actually even A-B test the pictures in each of the boxes to see which ones produce the most click through. They use, they're an ultimate choice engine. The only complaint some people have is they have a very important goal, but it may not be the watcher's goal. Their goal is to get you to watch as long as possible with the cheap, when you look carefully, with the least expensive programs to produce. You may love The Crown, but The Crown costs $10 billion an episode. If they were to produce The Crown for everybody, that would be ruinously expensive. So what they do instead is say, what can we get Eric to watch that is actually not going to cost us too much to show him? And given that, they do a great job of optimizing for them and keeping me modestly happy. But that's a good example. And notice you can learn. I didn't know that there was a show called Narcos. Or, oh yeah, Better Call Saul. It's reminding me I didn't know that existed, even though I was a big fan of Breaking Bad. So that's a site that actually gives me a lot of the three C's. I'm a little more concerned about sites like what happened there? Sorry. A little bit more worried about sites like Lending Club. It actually crashed. I haven't had that happen for a long, long time. What are you seeing, Kirsten?
So far, you're not sharing screen at all.
Oh, so that's what crashed. But at least you have me. I'll actually just talk through Robinhood and then stop. That will be just as fine. Robinhood basically makes it very easy to trade. It's a great website. You can buy a share of Tesla by typing TES and hitting return. Everyone reports it's a lovely website for that. At the same time, it has lots of features that encourage trading. We know that trading is not actually particularly good for people's wealth. In fact, what it is good for is for Robinhood. But it's a great case where a choice architect actually may be doing something that's better for them than it is for the chooser. Okay, I think I'll stop by saying one more thing. And I could talk about lots of things, so ask questions. And that is, many people have argued with choice architecture, designing choices, might not be ethical. that you're actually changing people's preferences. I'm actually convinced that's exactly the wrong answer. You are going to change people's preferences whether you like it or not. You are deciding what order to present options in. You're deciding how to describe them. You're describing everything we've talked about. You're actually making decisions now, often without awareness and implicitly. So as a designer, you're having an influence. It's either going to be purposive or it's going to be haphazard. And so that's one thing. There's no such thing as no choice architecture. Second thing is some work we've published recently actually looks at who's most affected by choice architecture. Who's most affected by defaults? Who's most affected by sorting? This is a paper that was published recently with Kellen McFarr, Crystal Reek, and Nate Posner in Journal of Marketing. And we argue strongly that it's the people who are most vulnerable, who don't know the area, who may have limited resources, that actually are most affected. So a bad default has its biggest effect on the people who don't understand the financial choice as well. Giving people more options has its most pernicious effects on those who aren't experts in the domain. So actually the argument I'm making is by not paying attention to decision design, you're actually hurting the people who are most vulnerable. It actually looks like the people who are well off can ignore choice architecture if they want to, or at least are not as affected. But by ignoring choice architecture, you're actually doing harm to a very important audience. So there is actually a very important issue there that I think is a much stronger argument to be made about why choice architecture is really important to understand and use. I think I'll stop there. I'll try and get a slide or two to work in case, but let's just chat. Any questions?
Well, first of all, I think everyone would love to give a big round of applause because I think everyone is very engaged. We had record turnout, so thank you so much for joining us today. And yes, please feel free to put questions in the chat or to raise a hand, and I see that we've already got a hand from Dale.
Hey, Dale.
Hey, Eric. Thank you. A very mellifluous talk, if there ever was one. And so full of deep ideas. I wanted to get your thoughts on two related kind of ethical issues. One is the fact that the leading tech companies have big back offices full of behavioral economists now. Uber is a great example, using choice architecture for their good. So how do we restrain this in the kind of society we have? Okay, that's one question. And the other is, what are the ethical constraints on using choice architecture for good? So if we want to encourage sustainable energy choices, we may want to lead consumers more than they want to be led. So what are your thoughts?
Not the share, sir. Hopefully you'll see, I'll see more of you. The first question is really good, and it's really good for two reasons. One is I think it's very hard to regulate the practice. I spent some time at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and in 2009, the Fed, before the Bureau started, made a device, something called overdraft protection, an opt-in decision. It turns out banks are very clever in getting people to opt in. So I think it may not be easy to do by saying you can't set a default. I think it's very difficult to regulate. The other thing that's relevant is twofold. One is that people, when they're warned about defaults, and this is earlier days, I'm not saying this is going to be the last literature, but with defaults at least, it looks like people who have been warned say, A, the default doesn't affect me, and B, it affects other people, but not me. And the third part of that, which is, again, new research, but people seem to underestimate the defaults. So, I mean, I think the tech companies who have done data-driven ways of understanding how effective are an exception. But if I asked, you know, walking around people, including, I think, MBA students, how big of an effect default would be, they can be surprised. So it suggests that there may be principles you can have. Like, for example, you might have to ensure that opting in is as easy as opting out. And that actually is, can be in part be defined empirically. You can actually have an empirical definition to say, here's a website. You want to ensure you have privacy. And in the early days, Apple, it was four clicks and a double negative to turn off tracking. That was an asymmetry. In computer science, they call those things dark patterns and asymmetries. They even have a cute name. They call some things customer hotels. After Virch motels from the old ads, customers come and they never leave. They make it so hard for you to reverse a decision. So I think principles like that are how one might have to regulate things. The second is actually a really important point, and it goes to something that I've thought a lot about, don't have a great solution. The book was written for designers so that they understand what they're doing. There's another book, and I'm not writing it, but someone should write, but I think if you read my book, you will have a leg up, which is, how does choice architecture work? I think education is on the part of consumers. The notion that we are the sole stewards of our own choices, I think, is empirically not true. And understanding those other influences is really important. Hopefully that answered it, Dale. Excellent question. Anik, I guess, I'm just going to call an order of the hands, if that's okay, Kirsten, unless you have better ideas. Hi.
Thank you. That was very interesting. So I'm working on a redesign of web services to make it easier for people to enroll in post-secondary education and participate in post-secondary education, particularly youth from low transition schools. And I'm wondering if you can give any examples of services you know of that do choice architecture for college choice or university choice really well.
There's a lovely paper, and I'm just going to blank, but send me a note and I'll send you a copy of the paper. A lovely economics paper that I think talks about framing attributes. They take kids who are, they have their standardized scores. They're from neighborhoods that normally don't send kids to the University of Michigan. And instead of telling them, you should apply, you have a high probability of getting a scholarship, they said, you're guaranteed a scholarship if you apply. And those effects are relatively amazing. It's in a task that is so hard because, what's driving decisions to go to college isn't just basically economic decisions, factors. So I would be glad to send that to you. But I think that's a fascinating problem, and I think that's a place where framing the attributes. For kids like that, it's particularly the case, it's a constructive preference. It's not they've known they're gonna go to college since they could first speak. For those of us who've been first generation students, it's actually has to be a very active opt-in choice. And so I think it's very likely choice architecture to make a difference. Send me a note and I'll be glad to send you that paper. But that's a good example of relabeling an attribute from, there's a high probability to your certain, assuming you get in, and it turns out to make a big difference.
Great, thank you.
It's a good problem.
Unfortunately, I think that's actually the last question we have time for, because it was such a rich discussion. You did put your email and your Twitter on the slide, so I took the liberty of putting them in the chat for anyone who's hoping to follow up. So Eric is at Prof. Eric Johnson on Twitter, and ejj3@gsb.columbia.edu, both in the chat. But thank you again for such a wonderful presentation and rich discussion. It was, for those who know you and for those who are less familiar with you, I think we all learned a lot. So thank you very much for joining us today. And thanks to everyone for calling in.
And thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, everyone. Hope we see you again. We'll be back in March.
And that was, I always get so into it that I just am out of my awarenesses. Let's see. That's something else. Okay, I already looked at that. This is always how the end, isn't it? It ends with me in a tizzy. Calendar, that was February 4th. It was UBC DIB seminar. So I wrote down a lot again. Turkey policy. That was the last one. The plausible paths is this one. Then the change info, the first generation student.